through the section on the holidays. If there's a holiday coming up and we haven't covered it yet, I always feel like we ought to rearrange the order so that we cover that holiday. So, who knows what's coming up this weekend? Right. And so who knows what these are?
Rockers.
These are the noisemakers that you use when you hear a certain name. This one's really bad. That's a good one. Yeah. Yeah. So, we're going to go to page 39 in your book, and we're going to go over the story of Purim. And Karen, I apologize because you got this morning. Karen volunteers in the morning, and when we got our little gathering for prayer and Bible study in the morning, we heard the story of Purim. But you're also going to hear it in the form of a video of a play that our youth and some adults did about 10 years ago. And that's going to be our service on Saturdays. We're going to show that video instead of a sermon. It's going to be the video.
The Feast of Esther?
Yes, yes. And the neat thing about the video is that a lot of the people in the play were in their teens when they did the play, and now they're parents. So you'll see them 10 years younger, and some of them are little kids. Actually, one of the girls who's in college now was in the play as like a 8-year-old or so, or 9-year-old. So that should be fun. Should be fun to see that. I hope she's going to be here to see it. But it's a great play. And but tonight I wanted to go through the story because I think it's good to read through it and kind of talk about some of the things that happen in addition to actually seeing it played out. And by the way, the idea of a play came through Jewish tradition because the traditional thing to do was to read the story of Esther. So read through the whole book of Esther on Purim. And then over time, people decided, well, let's dramatize this. You know, let's not have different people read the different characters. And pretty soon they got creative more and more, and it became something, actually got a name for it. It's called a Purim Spiel. And a Purim Spiel is these special plays that developed about Purim. And I actually think it's kind of the origin of a lot of the entertainment that's out there today, to have these humorous plays going on, because this tradition of the groggers, who knows when you're supposed to use the grogger?
When Haman's name is mentioned.
Boo! Whenever the name of the villain is mentioned, everybody boos and uses one of these groggers to make noise.
That style of play that they have the crowd participate in.
Yeah, yeah. So this became a raucous kind of thing, where every time the villain's name was named, everybody was boo hiss. So I really think it had a particular effect on the whole theatrical world, actually. But tonight we're gonna look at this, and on your notes there, there's places to take notes. But the event is celebrating the deliverance from destruction during the time of the Babylonian captivity. So if you know the history of Israel, when they got into the land, there was about 400 years where there were judges, and then there were kings. And there was about 20 kings. And through the years of those kings, the moral climate got worse and worse toward the end of them. And finally, the people were taken captive. Israel was conquered. People were taken captive. And they were in Babylon. And when they were in Babylon, they were it wasn't a friendly place, because they had been fighting against the Babylonians, and the Babylonians conquered them, and then they took them captive, and they were now living in the city of the Babylonians. So this was about 500 BC, about 1,000 years after Moses and 500 years before the time of Yeshua. So what happened was, there was a king, and here's your first Hebrew lesson This is part of the humor of the play. It's very difficult to pronounce his name, so people really struggle with it. But I'll say it. See how many of you can say it like this. Ahasuerus. Ah, pretty good. Okay, it was pretty funny this morning, right, Karen? When Jerry was trying to say the name. He couldn't get it. Finally, we said to him, just say the king, because we don't want to hear you try it anymore.
Gentiles can't
be there. Yeah. So he was the head of Persia, and this was an enormous empire. It stretched from India to Ethiopia, had 127 provinces. So this would have covered all of Egypt, Ethiopia, Israel, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Southwest Asia.
Southwest Asia, the whole thing there, yeah. And it was huge. And he became angry with his wife. Her name was Vashti, and removed her from her position. And then he commanded that all the beautiful virgins in the land be gathered and become contestants in a beauty contest for a new queen. And there was a young girl named Esther. Her Hebrew name is Hadassah. And she was an orphan. Both of her parents had been killed in the battles with the Babylonians. And she was being raised by her uncle Mordecai. And they were Jews, and they were living in Babylon. And one of the things that happens when you read the book of Esther is that you're surprised, kind of, that it's in the Bible, but there's no mention of God. And the studies that I've done on this, the Bible scholars have concluded that the reason there's no mention is because the author was afraid of mentioning God. So he was writing a history, but he was afraid to mention God because of the climate of persecution that the Jewish people were under. So there's no mention of God, but it's very clear as you go through it that the events happen because of the providence or the hand of God on things. And this Jewish orphan girl living among the captives was taken, actually against her will. It was a command of the king to be part of the beauty pageant, and she won the beauty pageant and won the favor of the king. And it actually was more than a beauty pageant. It was that each night a different girl went to spend the night with the king. So the king judged her more than just on her looks. It was on her character and everything about her. And hi, Allison. So Esther became the queen of Persia, and this was just a miraculous thing from an orphan girl. Allison, we are looking at the story of Esther Purim tonight because it's coming up, and 39 in your notes there. And sometime in there, after she became queen, a conspiracy developed against the king, and her uncle Mordecai discovered it. And the king's life was saved, but there was no recognition given to Mordecai for this. The king then appointed an evil man to be his prime minister. And, I didn't give these out. Here, pass these around, and each of you can have them for a while. And you can't do that until the evil man's name is said. Okay. The king appointed this evil man named Haman. Yeah, and the rest of you have to boo. Okay, that's it. And he basically appointed him to be like prime minister of the land. And everyone was supposed to bow down to Haman. You're getting there. But Mordecai refused. Mordecai refused to bow down. And this is an interesting thing that I discovered through my own studies. It always was a mystery to me. Why did Mordecai not bow down? And people have said things like, well, because Jews don't bow down to men. Well, that couldn't be true, because Mordecai would have had to bow down to the king, or he would have not been there. So what I found is that there's another book of Esther in the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is another set of writings that are not considered scripture, but they are historical. And there's a book, I think it's called Second Esther, in the Apocrypha. You can find the Apocrypha in a Catholic or an Episcopalian Bible, and you can find it online too. And in there, it says that Haman, Ooh. Oh, that was pretty weak.
Yeah,
Haman was actually involved in the conspiracy to murder the king that Mordecai had discovered.
Yay.
And that's why he wouldn't bow down to him, because he knew that this man was out actually to take the kingdom for his own. So his only way of dealing with this was this act of civil disobedience, and he refused to bow down.
I thought Mordecai refused to bow down to Haman because
boo!
He knew, but he didn't say the yay with Mordecai.
No, you don't have to say
yay.
Don't have to say
yay.
Boo!
They're getting better.
That must be how the Rocky
Horror
picture
anyone,
show.
But to God, and so since
Well, you've heard that. You've heard that. And I don't
that's
believe...
That's what I heard, is why Mordecai didn't bow down.
That's a Jewish tradition. But like I said, if he hadn't bowed down to the king of Persia, he would not have been part of the king's staff. And he was part of the king's staff. So I don't think that was the reason. So I searched for years for the reason. And then one day I found a book that had the Apocrypha in it. And I found this book of Second Esther. I didn't even know it existed. And when I read it, it was like... Haman was involved in the plot. That was weak.
Is the Second Esther in the Jerusalem Bible too?
If it's a Catholic Bible, it will be in there. Yeah. Yeah. So you can look it up. Okay. So we're going to, if you guys would open your Bibles to Esther, we're going to read some verses from the book of Esther. And
what is it in the Jewish Bible?
In the complete Jewish Bible, I always have trouble finding it. It's... okay, there it is, page 1089, and we're going to look at chapter 3.
In the Jewish Bible, they're ordered differently?
1091. If you have the complete Jewish Bible, it's 1091. If you have a Christian Bible, it's in there with Ezra and Nehemiah. I think it's right after Nehemiah.
Is it true the author's unknown?
What's that?
Do we not know who wrote it down?
No, nobody knows who wrote Esther.
Okay, so
No. So we're going to read chapter 3, verses 4 through 6. And David, why don't you try that?
Chapter 3, verses 4 through 6. All right.
And this is speaking about the other people who were in the court of the king.
But after they had confronted him a number of times without his paying attention to them, they told Haman,
boo!
In order to find out whether Mordecai's explanation that he was a Jew would suffice to justify his behavior. Haman,
boo!
Was furious when he saw that Mordecai was not kneeling and bowing down to him. However, on learning what people Mordecai belonged to, it seemed to him a waste to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Rather, he decided to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole of Asherah's Asherah. See, I can't. When you say it, I can say it.
Achashverus.
Achashverus' kingdom.
That was almost as good as this morning.
I killed that.
Okay, so one of the things that people struggle with, and this is really a significant point of understanding for all that we'll study here, is, come on guys, stop practicing. Why would he have wanted to destroy the Jewish people? Anybody have any idea? David.
This is a really neat part of the history. Mm-hmm. According to legend, Haman was a descendant of the Amalekites.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I believe the Amalekites were ordered to be wiped out during Saul's time.
Mm-hmm.
And Saul disobeyed God and did not wipe them all out. So they came back to haunt them in later generations, and that is who Haman's descendant was.
Yes, I believe that is true. Right. So that's part of the reason. That's kind of the human, natural reason for it. Anybody know any other reasons why he would have wanted to wipe out the Jewish people? He was just a mean guy. That's true. That's another natural reason.
Well, maybe also because they were like slaves there, right?
No, they were. They were.
On them or,
I think he
no,
was jealous.
They were more than
jealous,
slaves.
Yeah.
Jealousy.
Many.
What's that?
Many.
No, there weren't too many of them. No, there was plenty of room for them. Any other thoughts?
Population.
That's what I said.
No, think in the spiritual terms.
Oh.
This is about the battle that has been going on for millennium for God's plan to be accomplished or God's plan to be stopped.
Oh, the seed.
Right.
The seed of the genealogy of Jesus.
Well,
or
the enemy knew that the Messiah was going to come from where?
From the root of Jesse.
So he knew that the Messiah was going to come through the Jewish people.
Right.
So he also knew that the Messiah was eventually going to destroy him from the prophecies in the Bible. So all through history, the enemy has tried to stop that from happening. And this is the reason for the attempted destruction of the Jewish people over and over again. Anybody know other times? How about before the time of Esther? That was after, but that's a good one. Herod tried to destroy, what was that? Who else?
The Egyptians.
Yeah, Pharaoh tried to destroy the Jewish people. Anybody think of anybody else?
Nebuchadnezzar,
when he conquered Jerusalem, destroyed. And then that was all to prevent the Messiah from coming. How about, we're going to learn about this in a little bit later, but Hanukkah, we just celebrated.
The Maccabees.
Remember, the king there, Antiochus, he tried to destroy not just the people, but their way of life. Why? All that was to prevent the Messiah from coming. You see that? Then somebody brought up the Holocaust.
Yes.
So the question is, well, why would the attempts to destroy the Jewish people continue after the Messiah came?
Because so Israel couldn't be formed.
Right, so the prophecies would not be fulfilled about the return of the Lord. You see that? So this has been Satan's plan all along, and underlying all of the human things that we talked about. There, he was a mean guy, he was an Amalekite, he wouldn't bow to him, all of those things. Underlying that was the enemy attempting to prevent God's plan from happening. And we see it over and over again, this cycle. Right. You see it over and over again.
Just like the U.S. and Russia with the proxy war, the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
we fought through different countries. They're using, Satan's using evil men.
Oh, absolutely right.
Against Yeshua and the good people.
Right. And it's still going on.
Yeah.
It's still going on because why is there so much opposition to the state of Israel? Because the state of Israel has a role to fulfill in the end times. And that role has to be fulfilled before Yeshua comes back. And if that doesn't happen, then it actually will show that God is a liar. God can't keep his promises. So this is what we need to understand is that at the heart of all of the conflict that's happening in the Middle East right now, and it's actually at the heart of all those things in history that have been attempts to destroy the Jewish people, absolutely including the Holocaust. That was like almost like the final spasm. Let's try to wipe them all out. And of course, out of that came the nation of Israel.
They call it the final solution.
Final solution, right. Okay.
Solution.
So that's what's underlying this. And then the name Purim is a Hebrew word, and it's plural. If you start to recognize a little bit of Hebrew, you don't add an S in Hebrew. You add either an I-M or an O-T. Male is I-M and female is O-T at the end of words. So Pur in Hebrew means a dice. And Purim is dice, plural.
Lots,
yeah. And that kind of, that it's called that because after Haman was given permission, gosh, all sleeping there, was given permission to wipe out the Jewish people, he had to choose a time to do it. So he cast lots, and he came up with the day that we're actually going to be celebrating this weekend, the 13th day of the Jewish month of Adar, to actually destroy the Jewish people. And so the company is named for these lots, Purim. And then Haman went to the king, and he accused the Jewish people of being disobedient to the king's laws, and proposed to destroy them, and offered the king a lot of money if he would let him destroy them. So let's see. Toby, can you read 3:13?
Letters were sent by courier to all the royal provinces to destroy, kill, and exterminate all Jews from young to old, including small children and women, on a specific day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to seize their goods as plunder.
So if you can just imagine, this would have been in a sense, even worse than the Holocaust, because during the Holocaust, it was kind of hidden what the Germans were doing. But this was like, okay, on this day, everybody who's not Jewish can pick up their swords and their spears and their shields and go attack all the Jews and take all of their stuff. It wasn't just about killing people. It was about all of this bounty that you're going to get, too. So you can imagine the tremendous fear that the people must have felt. Just it's unimaginable to us living in, you know, a civilized country like this, what that would have been like. But it wasn't even to put them in prison or to take them off the camps like Hitler was threatening to do. It was just kill them. Just kill them all. Everyone, men, women, children, everyone's to be killed, and you get to keep their property. So the Jewish people responded with mourning and fasting and prayer. And again, the book of Esther doesn't say that they prayed, but you can bet they were praying when they were fasting. And Mordecai went to Queen Esther to intercede with the king to save the Jewish people. So in the chapter 4, verse 11, Albert, if you could read that, we'll pick up the story with Esther's response to Mordecai.
Can I skip
that? You don't feel, okay. Jana? Chapter 4, verse 11.
All the king's officials and the people of the royal province know that for any man or woman who approach the king in their inner court without being summoned to the king has brought one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king.
So Esther is saying, you know, I just can't walk in, even though I'm the queen. That's not how the protocol works in this court. And if I walk in without being invited, I could be killed if the king decides not to give me favor. And also, that you can see there's an underlying something going on here. And that is that why were they had not seen each other for 30 days. This is not normal. But something had become between them. And I believe that it was the king appointing Haman. Wake up, everybody. that had put an estrangement in their marital relationship, that Esther was not in favor of this, but there was nothing she could do, and they were estranged at this time. So, Julia, Mordecai's answer to Esther, which is a verse that maybe many of you are very familiar with, is a very familiar, very, very famous verse. Chapter 4, 13 and 14. This is Esther, Mordecai answering Esther.
And Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall there enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?
How many have heard that quoted? Who knows if you come to the kingdom for such a time as this? It's a really powerful statement by Mordecai.
It's destiny.
But also notice that Mordecai's faith was that, Esther, if you refuse, I know
God's will.
I know God has a plan here to rescue our people. So even if you refuse, he's going to do it. It's just that you're not going to get the glory for it, and he'll do it some other way.
Plan B,
right. Okay, David, would you read verse 16? This is Esther's answer, which is also very famous and often quoted.
Your similar Jews are found in Susa and Bethany. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. Thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish.
So I'm going to go. If I perish, I perish. And this 3 days of fasting, we're going to come back to this a little later, because again, in my studies of this book, there's something happening in the spirit world in this book that we need to be aware of, because it's an important lesson in spiritual warfare, and actually even a lesson for us, for this country and what we're going through right now, and for Israel. So Esther goes to the king, and in chapter 5, verse 3, we find the king's answer.
And the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you."
So the king looked favorably upon Esther when she appeared before him. And in Jewish tradition, it says that that she, actually in that book, Second Esther, it says this, that she fainted from the, you know, the stress of all this, and also the fasting probably for 3 days.
And dehydration.
And that dehydration, yes, I'm sure that would have been part of it. That was part of what moved the king's heart to turn toward her at this time. So what happened then was a very strange thing, and again, we'll understand this a little more when we talk about the spiritual warfare that was going on, is that rather than blurting out what was happening, she simply invited the king and Haman to attend the banquet. And at that banquet, again, she didn't say what was happening. She invited them to attend another banquet. And then at the second banquet, she finally spoke up. And Catherine, could you read chapter 7, verses 3 through 6?
Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, the men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king." Then King
Ahasuerus
said to Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he who has dared to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman."
Ooh. Ooh.
Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen.
So this was the final dramatic moment when she revealed what she had become before the king for. And when the king found out what was going on, he decreed that the villain would be executed. And then they had a problem, because in the Persian system of government, once an order had been given by the king and he'd signed it or put his signet ring on it, it couldn't be taken back. So Mordecai and Esther and the king did something to reverse the situation rather than cancel the order. And they issued another order, which said that when the Jews were attacked, they could defend themselves. And they could fight back and even take the spoil. And when the 13th day of Adar came, that did happen. They were attacked, but they were able to defend themselves, and they were able to defeat all those who attacked them. And so Mordecai established the day planned for the annihilation of the people as a day of celebration forever on this, the 14th day of Adar, which will be Sunday this year. So that's a short version of the story of Esther, and you'll see a much more in-depth and enjoyable version if you come on Saturday and watch the video. So today, Purim is celebrated actually for 2 days. We're celebrating it a little bit early just because it's actually Sunday and Monday, and we felt that it would be better to celebrate at our service rather than have a separate party. But the centerpiece of celebrating the holiday has always been the telling of the story. And the scroll on which the story is written is called the Megillah. So that's what you hear said, is that we read from the Megillah. And then, like I said, it became dramatized into Purim spiels. And part of that tradition is the booing of Haman.
Boo.
Yeah. And also part of that tradition is people dress up in costumes. So you've been hearing us announce this, and we're hoping that everybody comes in a biblical costume. But you don't have to be a biblical character necessarily. You could be something from the Bible, like somebody was saying to me they were going to come as a tree. because there's, you know, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So use your imagination. It doesn't just have to be like, you know, Esther or the king or Haman. It can be something more than that. We're going to have judging after the service. There's going to be food, and then there's going to be judging of the costumes. And also, it's traditional to have carnivals. We've done that some years where the people play games and raise money for a good cause. And, of course, there's a traditional food. And if any of you want to take a hand at making some of it, there's lots of recipes on the internet. It's called Hamantaschen. And you can hear the evil name right in the name of the pastry. So it actually... Nice. It actually means Haman's hat, is what it means. Which is, the tradition is that he wore a three-cornered hat. I don't know why, but the pastry is three-cornered, and they're simply three-cornered pastry with like fruity fillings, like apricots or plums or something, and they're folded over and baked like that.
Is that where your hat came from?
Oh, maybe. Maybe.
Well, that's fitting. He sounded like a real fruity guy anyway.
And
I read in online in Judaism 101 that Purim is the Mardi Gras.
Yeah, it takes the place of Halloween in the secular world, because it's a time for people to get to dress up,
right,
and, you know, have a costume party.
Also Mardi Gras.
And there's some negative traditions in the Jewish community that have developed around it. It's that the one time that people get drunk.
Big drinking, right? That's what they're saying.
Yeah. So. We don't participate in that tradition.
what do they do in Israel?
There's parades with people in costumes.
Like Mardi Gras?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, really?
Where would they dress up?
In the costumes?
That was a style back then.
Because I think it developed from the development of the plays. So people would put on costumes to be in the play, and then other people want to put in costumes, you know, and they, so everybody started getting into costumes. And it's also a time for giving to the poor. So it's also a time for collecting and giving to the poor. So I think we're going to have a great time Saturday morning, and we're going to celebrate it. Hope all of you come in costume. I'm going to come in costume, and we're going to judge the costumes. There will be prizes. We're going to have age group judging, so there'll be costumes, you know, like for the little children, maybe the bigger children, and then for adults.
You don't think the fire department would like it if I brought in a burning bush?
No. No. But if you were to make a costume to come as the burning bush, that would be awesome.
No pyrotechnics.
Yeah, we have the smoke detectors downstairs, and they go off. And if they do, we all have to leave the building, so we don't want to do that. So just to wrap up the Purim thing, just... the last question in your book that we kind of covered it, but see who has got this. What would have happened if Haman had succeeded?
Ooh. Well, the prophecy wouldn't be fulfilled and Yeshua would have
been. Right, because basically the Jewish people would have been wiped out at that point in time. And we know that Yeshua's ancestors must have come back from Babylon, because there were no people left in Babylon, not left in Jerusalem. They were all taken to Babylon. So they had to come back from Babylon, and if they'd all been wiped out across all of the empire of Persia, then there wouldn't have been anybody to come back. And
done it some other way.
Well, God would have done it some other way, it's true. But this plan, God's plan, would not have happened. So when I talk about this, especially with non-Jewish people who've never celebrated Purim, I point out that this is part of your heritage. If this hadn't happened, you would not have been able to come to know the Lord, because it wouldn't have happened this way. Might have been something else, but, you know, Satan would have won, basically. And the same is true about the other holidays where the people were, like Hanukkah, where there was these attempts to destroy the people or change the culture. And if the enemy had won, then this would have been, the world would have been very different.
You know? Well, God has his plan, and Satan will not win.
Yes.
I find it interesting, though, the prophecy to Samuel at Saul's time
kind of prophesied about the fact
yes.
this was going to, because God hated the Amalekites.
Well, it actually was back in Moses when he prophesied right. that. Moses, when the first battle with the Amalekites came, when the people of Israel were coming out, it was before they came to Mount Sinai. It was pretty early in the book of Exodus, and they were attacked by the Amalekites. And that was when God said through Moses, that you were to destroy the Amalekites. I will be against them because they attacked you when you were coming out of Egypt. And
would the snake in the garden be another time that you try to wipe out or try to stop it?
No, I think that the snake in the garden was the reason it was all needed.
Okay.
God's plan was needed. All of the things that happened afterwards that were attempts to stop the line, the line of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, were all the enemy's plot to prevent God's promises from coming about, and actually to demonstrate that God is not capable of fulfilling his promises.
Well, even Moses. I mean, Moses was hidden when
right.
Pharaoh
tried to destroy
to kill
Moses.
All the firstborn.
Right. Right.
So it was going back.
Yeah. Times. Yeah. And the reason that that's so important is because you will be often, if you're interacting with Jewish people especially, you'll encounter this thing of, why did the Holocaust happen? And whenever somebody asks me that question, it's a really often asked question by Jewish people when you talk about the Lord with them or you got to start to talking with them. I always bring people back to all of the other times that the Jewish people were almost annihilated. Why do we as a people have this history of people trying to destroy us and try to make the person see that there's this pattern? There was Pharaoh, there was Nebuchadnezzar, there was Antiochus Epiphany, there was Herod, there was Hitler, there was Haman, there was, this like six or seven times. And there was also the Stalin, there was the Crusades, all these times. Why does this keep happening to us over and over again? It's because God has a plan for us. And part of that plan is to have brought forth the Messiah, but then also to establish the state of Israel and to bring back the Messiah to Jerusalem, as he says he will do. And that often helps people kind of grasp, that the fact that there's this spiritual battle that's going on between good and evil, and that Israel is right in the middle of that and stuck kind of between the forces of good and evil.
Also, Tom wants to prove God to be a liar.
Exactly.
He wants to kill the Jews, and that means
right, right.
you can't trust his word.
Right. In fact, I don't know if any of you have ever heard this, but it's a pretty well-known quote. Queen Elizabeth, I think, not the person Queen Elizabeth, maybe it was Queen Victoria, was asking her archbishop or whoever it is, the head of the church in England, for a proof that God existed. And he simply said, Israel.
Yeah.
So, one word, proof. The proof that God exists is that the people of Israel are still alive. And that in our time, the fact that the state of Israel has been reestablished, that is absolutely amazing. If it was 70 years ago, 80 years ago, people wouldn't even dream that could have happened. 70 years ago was 1942-43, right the middle of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And the Jewish people were basically being destroyed. And if you said, well, someday the Jewish people could have their own homeland, people would laugh at you. But out of that came the state of Israel, and much closer, much more obvious that God's plan is being fulfilled as we watch on our television screens or on the internet, we see it being fulfilled. So the story Purim all has, it fits right into that whole puzzle.
History repeats itself.
Yeah, yeah, especially this part of history. Right, right. So any questions?
Are you going to be reading the entire book of Esther during Sabbath service on Saturday morning?
No, we're going to be showing a movie of one of the plays that primarily our youth group did, but there's a couple of adults in the play also. And we're going to, because as I think you missed it, the tradition originally was to read from the scroll
right.
of it, but then it developed into creating dramas of it. And so that's what we're going to do. And we are, it's interesting how a congregation goes through kind of a, like a life cycle. There were times when we had tons of youth here. We had a huge youth group, and they did all these plays for years. And now all those youths have grown up, and they have kids themselves. So we have all these little kids. They're not quite old enough to put on a play yet. So, but in a few years, we'll have a new play coming along, I think.
The Lord willing.
Huh? The Lord willing, right. And maybe Sophia or Emma will play Esther. In this play, actually, what you'll see is a performance that we did at the University of Rochester. So we actually took this thing on the road. We put it on at RIT. We put it on at the U of R. We put it on at the Harley School. We rented that auditorium. We put it on at New Hope Church out in North Chilai. There was a lot of places where we did this play over the years. But I think the last time we did it was 2008. So it's been a while since we did it.
So this Saturday is not a traditional Shabbat service. It's
yes,
more
very
of
different.
A play.
It'll be different because there'll be a play, or the video of the play. It won't be the live play.
So
there'll be people dressed in costumes.
Right.
And then after the service, there'll be the costume judging and
food.
Would
it be considered a desecration of a Shabbat service to a non-believer?
I don't know how they would.
You mean like someone who's used to going to synagogue for a Sabbath service?
Yeah, I don't know if the traditional synagogues incorporate Purim into their service. They might have a Purim party later. I've never checked that out. But I know I saw the flyer for this year's JCC Purim party.
Right. That's
and
on Sunday.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of the same elements we have. They're going to do a play, and they're going to have costumes, and they're going to actually have a carnival, and all those things. So, yeah, I'm not sure. It might be. Are you thinking of bringing somebody? Alan?
Yeah, because he invited me to his synagogue Saturday night because they're actually going to read the book of Esther
okay.
in his synagogue, and it's read in Hebrew.
Uh-huh. All right.
Because it actually starts sundown Saturday
right.
night.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
So
I would suspect in the Orthodox synagogues that they wouldn't do.
I actually got invited to go.
Okay.
To a synagogue
yeah.
service.
Yeah.
In Miami. It's been a year. Hello. So that's
okay.
What I was wondering.
Yeah, I think this would probably be not
because
the
it
best.
Would be not offensive to him to come because it's not really a service.
Well, it is our service. It is our Shabbat service. I mean, we'll have worship.
But it's a different format service. It's not like the traditional service.
It's going to be pretty much the same service. Except for the movie will replace the sermon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're still going to do the Tillit praying at the
yeah.
beginning?
Yeah, there'll still be
so
some of the liturgy.
Still all of that and
yeah.
the Aaronautic blessing and all that stuff.
Yeah,
so
but it'll be a little while because everybody's going to be in costume.
No. The question is, can God use it anyway?
Yeah.
Yeah.
God uses everything.
Yeah.
Even if you screw it up, he can still use it.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because here's an example right here.
Yeah, he's a pretty good handyman.
It's a real hot mess, and if God can fix this, he can fix anything.
Okay, well, we've got about 20 minutes left here, so let's turn back in your book to page 26. We finished with the Shabbat, and page 26 and 27 is this chart.
Yes.
Okay, so you actually could fill out the lowest line on the chart now.
Feast of Esther.
Yep.
What's the Ashkenazi name for it?
It's the same,
Purim.
Right. There's only a few of them that differ in how the words are pronounced.
The time of year would be
the time of year is early spring. The biblical reference is the book of Esther.
Yes, that's filled in.
And it's important to religious Jewish people. Not everybody celebrates it who is secular. And it commemorates the victory of Esther and Mordecai.
Is it considered a minor holiday or not?
Yes,
even?
Yes. And it's interesting because it's not commanded by God, like the holidays like Passover and Feast of Tabernacles, but in the Book of Esther, Mordecai commanded the people to keep it forever.
What's the prophetic meaning? That's about the
prophetic meaning is that Yeshua could not have come without this victory. So now if you turn your page, we're going to spend about 15 minutes looking at Passover, which is the next holiday coming up. And we're going to start out by talking about the two holidays that start on the 14th and 15th of the next Jewish month. This month is Adar, which is the last month of the calendar. The next month is Aviv or Nisan. For some reason, it has two names, but that's the first month on the Jewish calendar.
That'd be like January.
Well, it's in the spring, though.
Oh, yeah.
But it's the first month on, and maybe there's some confusion here. There's a couple of different ways of reckoning the year in Judaism,
okay,
because the holiday called Rosh Hashanah in the fall is called the Jewish New Year, but
okay,
the first month is in the spring.
Okay.
Now, why is that? You think that the New Year would be in the first month?
Yeah, you would.
So
it's like celebrating New Year's on July 4th.
I think it's because
right,
it's the lunar calendar.
The
no, it's the months are reckoned as the first month according to the Bible. Because in the scriptures it says, "This shall be the first month of your year." Okay. But for some reason, some people believe that before the time of Moses, when Moses recorded the commandment that said that the month in the spring shall be the beginning of the year, before that time the people had been celebrating it in the fall, and they just never changed. That's one way of reckoning it. The other really interesting way of reckoning it is that according to Jewish tradition, creation happened on Rosh Hashanah. So the year, if you're counting years, they started on Rosh Hashanah, first year, second year, okay? But God said the beginning of your year shall be in the spring, so we say the first month is in the spring, but the New Year's is in the seventh month. It's the other thing that might help people understand this is that there's actually four New Years in the Jewish calendar. And the other two New Years is that there's a New Year for the trees, which was in January.
It just had.
And there's a New Year for the animals in August. And the meaning of those New Years is that when you're reckoning your tithe, like you're reckoning your tithe from your fruit trees, you reckon it from the New Year for the trees to the next New Year for the trees. And when you reckon your tithe from your flocks, it's reckoned from the New Year for the animals to the next New Year for the animals.
Is that like
so
a fiscal year?
That's and that's what we have. You know, like many companies and even the federal government,
yes,
they don't reckon the year from January 1st.
No,
fiscal year.
There's a fiscal year.
July 1st to June 30th.
And there's other times. Some companies have a fiscal year like odd times. Like our congregation has a fiscal year that goes from July 1st through June 30th. Other companies have different. The federal government, I think it's like November 1st through October 30th or something like that. And there's another year that we have in our culture that starts in September. What is it?
School.
The school year. Yeah, everybody calls it the school year, and it goes like that. So it's not so strange that there'd be these different years. Anyway, the first month is called Aviv or Nisan, and who knows what the two appointed times are that start. One starts on the 14th and one starts on the 15th. Anybody know?
14th is Passover.
Passover, and Passover starts at sundown on the 14th. And then on the next day, unleavened
bread.
And it's important to understand that there are actually two different times. Passover is just one, according to the Bible, is just one evening. And unleavened bread is 7 days. And it starts on the day after Passover.
Because that's when the Jews were.
Deuteronomy 16:16.
That's when the Jews actually left
each unleavened bread, each of weeks, each of
Right, those are the three pilgrimage feasts.
Right.
So let's take a look at a scripture. I don't know, who are we up to? Catherine read Larry. Larry, Leviticus 23, and again, you know, whenever you want to know something about the holidays, go back to Leviticus 23, and if you'll find all the holidays there. It's called God's calendar. But also, if you have a, you know, a Bible with references in it, it'll give you the other scriptures about those holidays if you're looking through Leviticus 23. So read 5 through 8, if you would, Larry.
Okay. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, between sundown and complete darkness, comes Pesach for Adonai. On the 15th day of the same month is the festival of Matzah. For 7 days you are to eat matzah. On the first day you are to have a holy convocation. Don't do any kind of ordinary work. Bring an offering made by fire to Adonai for 7 days. On the seventh day is a holy convocation. Do not do any kind of ordinary work.
So we had the answer to the next question there in that verse.
Pesach.
It's got, and again, it's got one of those ch's on the end. Pesach. And let's see, Karen, are you able to answer a question, or what is commemorated by Pesach, Passover?
The Exodus, leaving Egypt.
Yes, so it's the deliverance of the Jewish people from slavery in Egypt, and through Moses and the plagues and all of the things that happened, the parting of the Red Sea.
It's also death angel passing over.
All of those, that's one of the plagues, right. And so how do we celebrate? Well, the main part of Passover is something called a Seder. And a Seder, the word Seder, it simply means order. So what it means is the order of the ritual meal that was commanded to be kept by the Lord, and which tradition kind of filled out. Well, how do we keep it? Because the instructions from the Lord were just a few, what you were supposed to eat on this time, and then the things that were added to it. So we'll be having a traditional Seder, or Messianic Seder, in the end of March, and hopefully you guys can come. How many of you have been to a Seder before? Okay, so about half, and hopefully the rest of you can get to come. We made a big change this year. It always used to be an evening meal, and we decided this year to do it as a lunch on Saturday instead of an evening meal, mostly to reduce the price, because over the years, the price at the party house that we go to, it's Burgundy Basin, has just kept going up and up and up. Every year they raise it. So by doing lunch, it's going to be a lot less expensive. And we're also hoping, because we have so many little children now, to be able to get the little children to come, because it's daytime and not at night. So it's going to be a little bit different this year. But in tradition, it's not done like in a big party house. Traditionally, the pastors of a Seder is done in a home. And in my family, it was always done in the home of the patriarchs. You know, like my family, myself and my parents, we would always go to my grandparents' home for it. And so whoever was the oldest one, my grandparents died, then one of their children took it on, and all of the relatives came to that house. And it's a time of gathering family and joy and celebrating. There's songs in it, and it's telling the story is the main component of it. Just like Esther, the main thing is to tell the story, to pass it down through the generations. And the other really important thing about it is that God knows us so well, and He knows that if He makes a covenant with us, if we didn't renew it periodically, we would, after a while, forget it. So the Passover Seder is actually what's called the covenant renewal meal of the Mosaic Covenant. And you'll find the scriptures on it say that unless you do this every year, you're to be cut off from your people. So it was an absolute, very strict command that the Jewish people would have to keep the Passover, or else they would not be considered part of the people anymore. And in keeping it, God gave certain foods to eat that would make it more memorable. Like, it's kind of like when you do something, you know, you remember it better than we just hear about it. So you'll see as we talk about it and as you experience it that there were certain things that were done that, that would make it more memorable. And also, God commands it to be for the sake of the children, to pass it down through the generations. This was how the children were to learn what the history of our people was all about. And I have to say, it worked, because here we are, 3,500 years from the time of Moses, and we're still doing it, and we're still passing it down. And even in all the ways in which we've made it not effective, it still is effective, because it's done, and the children learn about it. And I'll tell a little bit about how ineffective it can be, how it was in my family. But so the Seder commemorates this coming out of Egypt, but it also commemorates the giving of the Mosaic Covenant at Mount Sinai. So it goes all the way from Moses in the bushes, you know, being born and being put in the bulrushes and being rescued. The story goes all the way from there, all the way to Mount Sinai with the covenant being given on Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments basically being given. So I want to show you something that goes along with the Seder. I'll pass these around. You can all take a look at them. I'll just pass a couple around each way. These are Haggadahs. And I brought a sampling because there's lots of them out there.
We've seen these.
You've seen them before, okay? But basically, these are what Jewish people use to take them through the Seder. You follow the instructions in the Haggadah, and it has the prayers to recite, and it tells the story. And usually, there's commentaries by the rabbis in there. There's pictures, and it's interesting. The coffee companies are the ones that originally made. Maxwell House Coffee was the one that I always remember. The Maxwell House Coffee Haggadah was the one that...
Hebrew.
It's right to left, yep. Yeah. And the one that's going around there is ours. We created a Messianic one that we use at our Passover Seder. And that's quite different.
So what's the Ashkenazi Hebrew name for Passover?
They're both the same, Pesach.
Oh, it's Pesach?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
The prophetic meaning is the Mosaic Covenant?
Well, we'll get to that.
Oh, yeah,
we'll get to that.
I just
want
to
make sure you didn't miss
it. You're not missing. More prophetic meanings to that.
So let me let's see how much time have we got here tonight. We are running at almost an hour. So let me just tell a little bit of the story, and then we'll pick it up next week. God predicted this exodus, the slavery in Egypt, to Abraham in the book of Genesis. And if you've read through the book of Genesis, you know that toward the end of the book, there's this whole story of Joseph. It takes up many of the chapters of the book of Genesis, the last book. It's a wonderful, it's almost like a novel to read it. And in the story of Joseph, Joseph goes down into Egypt as a slave, and he becomes the prime minister of Egypt. And then there's this terrible famine in the land. And because of the famine, Joseph's family comes down to buy food, and they're reunited down there, and they move to Egypt, about 75 people. They move to Egypt, and the Egyptians are just very thankful for them, because Joseph basically saved the nation of Egypt from this famine that was on the whole land. But then the years start to pass, and the Jewish people are blessed by God tremendously, and they multiply enormously, from 75 people, and 480 years pass. And you know, some of the biblical accounts, we just don't grab the scope of the time spans. 480 years is like twice as long as this country has existed. It's really a long time. And they were in Egypt, and they multiplied to the point where they were so numerous that the Egyptians began to fear them. And they were afraid that the Israelites would side with their enemies if there was ever to be a battle. So they began to enslave them and treat them cruelly. And that's where the book of Genesis picks up. I mean, Exodus. In Genesis, they're loved by the Egyptians, but Exodus is 480 years later, and they become slaves, and they're building the store cities of Egypt, and it's a terrible, terrible time. And the worst part about it is that the Pharaoh, to keep them from multiplying, decreed that all of the male children would be killed by drowning in the river. So Moses' parents hid him when he was born, and then they put him in the river. And the amazing providence of God was that his little basket that he was floating in down the river floated in front of Pharaoh's daughter, and she saw this beautiful baby floating in the basket and took pity on him and rescued him and raised him as her own son. And when she raised him as the son, he grew up in the court. He became very educated. One of the things that's a theme of the whole Passover and Exodus is that the people who were enslaved, they had like a slave mentality. They were used to being abused. But Moses was not like that at all. He was raised in the court. He was like, you know, a prince. So he was very different. And he was called by God to rescue the people from this terrible thing, which again is very similar to Purim. Pharaoh was basically trying to destroy the people. If you kill all the male children, pretty soon the people will disappear. So Moses, when he was about 40 years old, decided it was time for him to go out and check out his people. He saw that they were in great, great distress, and he decided to try to help them, and he got into big trouble, and he had to flee and go into exile, and he was in exile for 40 years, and then Larry's costume that he's going to come in appeared to Moses, and God called him to go back and rescue the people. And I think we'll stop there, and we'll pick up the story next week.
So the Passover was important to the Jewish people?
Passover?
Yeah, on what?
On the chart. We'll fill in the chart. Yep, it's important to almost all Jewish people.